This is CliffCentral.com.
My buddy was saying to me she's a little bit bored with the weekend sound, huh? That's a very controversial statement. A little bit bored, huh? Tell me.
No. Just that exactly. I won't add anything further.
I just think that 50 Shades of Grey killed his career for me, because all his songs to me sound like he's got some sort of woman tied up in the background. And he's just doing like devious things, but because he's good looking, he gets away with it.
You reckon, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I don't have any simple ideas in my head, do I?
No. Everything's complicated with you, Ben. I mean, we're still stuck on Tupac being killed by Will Smith.
And well, that's not an idea. I mean, you do get in reality as well.
Sorry, what did you say? That's not an idea.
No. Sometimes you can't accept the truth. You have to keep fighting it.
Okay.
All right. Okay, well, let us get into some news. This is why we let Mabali do the news and not Ben. Because otherwise it wouldn't be news. It would be conspiracy theory.
Huh.
What do you have for us, Mabs?
Well, I might be bordering on a conspiracy theory here, but if the Sunday Times is to be believed, there might be something happening in the background.
What?
I actually missed the story yesterday, but yes, apparently there have been informal talks happening between Patricia de Lille and the ANC. And would it really be that surprising if it turns out to be true? So the ANC have made overtures to de Lille in the hope that once her relationship with the DA is terminated for good, she can help them win back support in the Western Cape, specifically with the coloured communities, where she is hugely popular. The newspaper understands that these informal approaches began in February already.
Right.
And are being handled from Luthuli House, led by the elections team. It's understood that during discussions with de Lille, she had indicated her preference for a diplomatic posting to the US once her battles with the DA are over.
Ooh, she wants to be our ambassador in the US, huh? And that would be her prize for helping them win back the Western Cape. Well, the DA must be shitting themselves. The DA's assholes must be chomping at the bit at the moment. That's just not cool for them. Yo.
A senior ANC leader who asked not to be named confirmed that informal talks are taking place. Quote, yes, there have been those talks on the sidelines, but of course this cannot be made public for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Even the ANC elections head, Fikile Mbalula, told the newspaper there could be individuals who might have made an approach, but there had been no formal talks.
Ooh. How exciting.
Ah, politics, you dirty, slimy game, you.
Isn't it bad, huh? Sure, but it's got to be. I mean, this is exciting stuff. Because Patricia will turn that whole DA thing in the Western Cape on its head. She could easily win a whole lot of votes back. This is not good for the DA in any way. It's like someone short-circuited the brains of all the people in charge of the DA and just said, all right, we need you to fuck up now because your politics have become way too stable.
Hmm.
Really? Like, let's mess you up. Oh, I'm going to sneeze.
That was more of a...
Yeah, it started...
A snuff.
It started badly. A snuff?
Well, a sneeze-cough combo.
Snuff.
I don't know. It sounded like you were coughing in the middle of that as well.
All right.
Okay.
What did you think of that?
I think they are germs that have now sprayed in Ben's direction, in my direction. Some have landed on Sia's laptop.
Lucky you.
Okay, this is a very strange story, okay?
Yeah.
Canada, I mean...
Canada, eh?
Canada, not really much happens in Canada. You know, they're all kind of happy. They get along.
Yeah.
There's no real, like, aggression that happens there. But there is a strange mystery that the Canadians are trying to solve. And it is the mystery of the dismembered feet.
What?
I remember this.
What? What do you remember, Ben? This is the first time I've seen any of this.
You told us the story months ago.
I did not.
This story has come up. Dismembered feet in Canada.
So a man was out for a Sunday afternoon stroll on a British Columbia beach.
Different man, because the other ones have obviously got no feet.
When he made a gruesome discovery, a human foot in a hiking boot lodged in a pile of wood. Authorities.
Sorry, I know we shouldn't be laughing.
No. Authorities aren't saying much more about the foot, except for the fact that it is the 14th foot that has been found washed up on a shoreline over the past decade in or around that area.
Ben is right. This is something that's come up a couple of times. We've discovered Canada has this thing with feet.
Are you not talking about the sex toy shaped as a foot?
No, we're talking about
what
feet.
Is it called? The vajankle. The vajankle.
It's funny how I remember certain stories, Sierra remembers different stories.
The vajankle.
9 of the 14 feet have been identified. Guys, what's happening in Canada?
How do I identify?
It gets cold there, and then your feet snap off. That's how cold it gets.
Snap off?
Well, a bear pushes you, maybe bites you a bit, but essentially your feet snap off.
Okay.
No, the killer is on the loose here.
All right.
Yeah, it's called winter.
And officials determined that they belong to 6 people. According to the British Columbia Coroner's Service, no foul play was involved in the previous cases. What? No foul play with just feet.
Feet missing?
Washing up on shore.
Feet don't just pop off a body.
Good Lord. Canada's got major problems. You know, it's like that Austrian country, yeah? In Austria, they all think they're very civilized and, you know, the roads are all well-maintained and, you know, the lawmakers do responsible things and the place is generally in good condition. And then Joseph Fritzl pops up. Mm-hmm. Same in Canada. It's all very chilled and calm and beautiful and fantastic and lovely. And then suddenly the foot guy turns up out of nowhere and starts chopping off people's feet.
Justin needs to talk to his people.
Yeah, where's Justin from Canada when you need him?
The reason that police believe there's no foul play involved is because they believe the remains could be from suicides and accidental drownings.
Yes,
but then how do the feet become detached from the body?
That doesn't just happen. Your foot doesn't fall off when you die.
Are people in Canada okay? No one's batting an eyelid, raising an eyebrow to this. It's just another day at the office.
Are you kidding? I bet you in Canada this is headline news on every channel because they don't get news so often.
So with this latest discovery that was made
they're
this
past... They're still talking about Alanis Morissette and Justin Bieber.
The latest foot, authorities determined, belonged to a 79-year-old Washington State man who had gone missing almost 3 months earlier.
The latest foot. I mean, what a headline.
How many latest
24
foot.
24 in total, right?
14.
14 pairs of foot.
Yeah.
Pairs of feet.
Yes.
It's a lot of feet lying around.
It's a lot of feet that just wash up on shore and no foul play involved.
Nah, there's foul play. Trust me. Canadians trying to disguise this sick thing that's going on there.
Doesn't it just sound like a serial killer who wants to leave their signature? Yeah.
It's got a foot fetish.
Yeah, it does sound a bit dodge.
All right, so what do we do, Sia?
Look, you lock your doors and you just look at the outside world through your blinds. Nah.
Yes.
The killer is on the loose.
Killer on the loose.
I'm telling you, and also just like, I don't know, wear long socks. You don't want to tempt them by showing off your ankles.
Look, I suppose.
What if wear long socks.
What if their
great...
mouth starts watering when they look at your ankle? Like,
that's fantastic.
The things I'd love to do to your foot. No, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the feet that get left behind. They're probably doing things to legs and your bowels, that kind of stuff. The feet are the things that wash up.
The
feet.
Also, they don't want.
The feet are the part that they don't want, yeah.
Oh. It could just be a cannibal, too.
I don't like feet, hey?
Yeah, they're gross.
I'm the opposite of a person with a foot fetish. Maybe I'm like this guy. I'd cut off the feet. Mm. Keep the rest.
I've realized fingers are weirder to me than feet.
Feet
I can stomach. Fingers,
you are such a strange human being. What do you mean they're weirder for you? What's weird about a hand or a finger?
Ugh. Have you not seen the Addams Family, the original one?
The thing walking about? No, thanks.
That's going to rock your world.
No, thanks.
Okay.
All right, what else?
Calling all time travelers, you are being invited to a rather special event. Mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking's family have invited time travelers to his memorial service, seeking to tackle one of the curiosities that eluded the British physicist during his life.
Yes.
The world's most recognizable scientist died in March at the age of 76 after a lifetime spent probing the origins of the universe, the mysteries of black holes, and the nature of time itself. Now, members of the public are being invited to apply for tickets to attend a celebration of Hawking's life. at a memorial service in Westminster Abbey. It's happening exactly a month from today, the 15th of June, where his ashes will be placed alongside the graves of Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin.
That's a biggie. Wow, what an honor.
Now, those wishing to apply have to fill in a form and state their date of birth, which can be any date up to the end of 2038. Huh. Now, if you're getting a little bit confused, here's the explanation.
I'm confused.
Well, Professor Hawking once threw a party for time travelers to see if any would turn up if he posted the invite after the party. None showed up, but...
Wow.
I mean... None showed up, but it seems perfect that the memorial website allows people born in the future to attend this service. It's all kooky.
Don't you like this?
It's so strange.
What does he think? So he thinks there are people who are already in the future?
No, well, listen.
Like, if you lived in the future, all right, and you decided to come back, let's say he gave a really good party.
Yeah.
Oh.
And you wanted to be at that party, but you lived in the future.
Yeah.
You'd be able to time travel to that moment and accept the invitation that he'd only given out after the party. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to judge him here for his kookiness.
No. So. I mean, this was his thing. You know, part of his interest was how, you know, the nature of time itself and the whole concept of time travel.
Right.
So I think his family are just playing on that in this instance and trying to make it seem, you know, like a... like a funny little enjoyable memorial service.
Sure. Yeah. Did he get dressed up and sit at the dinner table and just wait?
I don't have those exact details here.
That's one of those classic cases where they say it's what he would have wanted.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is great. Do it. Let's see who pitches up. Maybe there'll be some guy from the future.
Sure. I mean, if you're interested, it's happening at Westminster Abbey on the 15th of June. And no, you get to apply.
Are you going
to
go?
To apply for tickets.
Anyone going?
Mm-mm.
No, Ben?
I'm giving that one a skip.
Mabs,
no. No. Okay. I can't that day.
All right.
That's the only reason
why I have something on. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Stephen Hawking, what a nut job. Total nut
what
case.
What an intelligent nut job.
Total nut case, though. Hey, watched another episode of Billions last night.
You're really getting into this. Hey?
Jesus, it's a good show. Wow. I mean, this plot, look, there's one or two little things that I think are very difficult to discern whether or not the writers have actually figured some of this out. But most of it is so well worked out. You know, they lay things down and things turn out this way and almost makes me want to write a TV show.
That has been the one thing that fascinates me the most. In shows that I've watched and that are thrilling to the point where there's this plot twist that you never saw coming, I really do admire writers. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall to see the entire process of how they cook these things up.
Oh, yeah. That's good, Sia, because they don't get paid a lot. So if you admire them, at least it's something.
Oh, geez.
Really?
Yeah. On these big shows?
Someone says, you have to look at Maps Maponyane's Instagram. He has the worst feet ever. Michelle.
Oh, I mean, if that's the case, that's fine. Because him and his girlfriend have questionable feet. And this is not me being horrible. This is like a fact of life. So it's fine. Their feet can, you know.
Yeah, let them have children. The children will look like hobbits or Sasquatches.
Sure.
Ooh, and they rub up against each other.
Sure.
Imagine those feet under the covers.
Yeah. Like, they'll probably start a spark based on their rough feet, flints.
But they had to have something wrong with them because both of them are just like these supremely good-looking human beings.
Yeah,
had to be something wrong.
Right.
So it's their feet.
I agree.
It's allowed.
And we will make fun of their feet as we like because it's all we've got to mock them about.
Yeah.
Someone says feet are beautiful, vaginas are ugly.
Wow. Well, I don't disagree with that one either.
Someone says call this guy in Canada the footloose killer.
Okay.
And then somebody else said it's very easy to explain. A dude drowns, a shark chomps on his leg, foot is in shoe, so it's not tasty. That's why the foot survives. What do you think of that?
Or we prefer our conspiracy theory.
Not far.
Here's talking about conspiracy theory. Someone saying, Gareth, yesterday you're talking about cows who enjoy being milked is absolute bullshit. You're one of the cleverest people I know, but normally, but you sounded ignorant and backward as hell yesterday. I love the show though, guys. Keep it up.
Oh, yeah, is that your response to that message? Is that
Ben? How is Hopkins? We haven't heard how Hopkins versus Meowsers is going.
Sure,
that's from Matthew.
Hopkins gets the crap beaten out of him every day, and he just steps up again. Like Meowsers just drills him.
Really?
He's
resilient,
irrepressible spirit.
Huh.
Like he's cool, but he's a bit of a dick sometimes. Like he's just got all this energy, and he doesn't know when to stop. Meowsers is like, okay, enough. But it's some proper fighting going on.
Oh, jeez.
Look, it's not bad. I mean, there's no blood or anything too malicious, but like there are some body slams being... I mean, Meowsers could have actually taken Ronda Rousey's career and probably kept it on the straight and narrow. So he's really got some moves.
Does Hopkins like Daniela, though? Because the whole reason that you got her Hopkins and you've got Meowsers is because Meowsers didn't like Daniela.
Yeah, well, Meowsers still doesn't like Daniela, but Hopkins is... Hopkins definitely prefers her to me. Like he baths with her and it's going well.
All right. Well, as long as the cats are happy, then you two could be happy.
I was making a video yesterday and like the two of them, they sit on the table and then mid-take, I don't do many takes. I just do it and then I edit it. And they had this full-on fight, like massive.
They scream at each other as well.
Meowsers beat the crap out of him and I'm like trying to stay composed and make a point about this whole rugby thing. Anyway, I kept it in the video. It's pretty funny.
Cats are weird.
They are. They're very, very strange, but that's good to have that in your life.
By the way, the message that we received earlier that was accurate. South Africa's first cryptocurrency ATM is opening in Johannesburg by the end of this week.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's the point? I mean, isn't cryptocurrency meant to be something that you don't need to actually physically get out of a machine?
So the entire function of this ATM, they say, is the ability to process the likes of Dash and Ethereum and Bitcoin and others, and will open in Johannesburg by the end of this week. And they say that users will be able to buy cryptocurrencies at the ATM as well.
Okay.
And they'll be able to exchange cash for cryptocurrencies without a bank account even.
Yeah, that's going to work great with commission and fees. You try to sell cryptocurrency through an app online, you get drilled.
Mm. We'll talk to Simon about that as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Simon's our guest at 7:30, Simon Dingle, and he could tell us all about this stuff.
I was going to say, Michelle, fake news. I've spent the last 10 minutes going through Math Mapanyani's Instagram account. There's not one picture of feet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm supporting Maps here, you know.
How did your morning start off, Ben?
I'm defending him. He's
scrolling
nice guy.
Through Maps' Instagram, looking for his feet.
Not a single picture of feet.
All right, let's move on. There's other news.
All right, it's time for a royal update.
Oh God! All right, here we go. I knew this was going to be the week to hear about all this stuff. Okay, take it away.
So yesterday it was revealed that Thomas Markle has been, you know, he's been talking to paparazzi and he's been staging all kinds of photo shoots, you know?
Fabulous.
Well, Thomas has now told the American tabloid TMZ that he will no longer attend his daughter's wedding to Prince Harry.
What?
Oh, shock. Yeah. Horror. Shock horror.
No, don't do this. I'm sorry. I love how I'm saying, okay. I just saw myself involved there.
But then, okay, let's also
He also said he had a heart attack.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, that I didn't know.
The headline in the Daily Mail is that he says he had a heart attack because of the whole situation around his daughter and the staged photographs that he took. And he's very embarrassed. The headline in the Daily Mail is this. Meghan Markle's father says he will not attend the royal wedding because he suffered a heart attack and does not want to embarrass his daughter after it was revealed he staged the paparazzi photographs.
Okay.
Yes.
Or maybe this is... Ooh.
He's 73. He admitted to receiving money, but said it was not his main motivation. Oh, that changes everything. And he had been hoping to recast his image in the wake of unflattering pictures.
Yeah, and now
what an embarrassment.
Oh, okay.
Now that all of this is out, that these pictures are staged, don't you sort of see it now? Like, okay, Thomas, couldn't you just read at home? Why did you have to go to a coffee shop to read?
Yeah.
And also, why did you have to sit by the window with your book strategically facing outside? We see right through you.
Guys, I reckon this is the royal family's gift to the tabloids of Britain. This really is. This wedding is a gift.
Well, Meghan Markle's family seem like a gift as well, because it'll take exactly the heat off of the royals. They've got a new focus.
I reckon when Harry was always hanging out with those chicks like called Chelsea and Cressida and Corolla and Maxim, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
The press got so bored because they're all the same squeaky clean backstory. So eventually they said, look, you guys have got to give us more, otherwise we can give you pressure about, you know, tax money and all that kind of crap. And they go, okay, fine. Harry's going to marry a mixed race actress with a questionable family history. And they're like, oh, thank you. That's enough. We'll leave you alone for 10 years.
I mean, and they sacrifice Harry.
They sacrifice Harry.
They don't need, because Harry they don't need, right? He's the spare.
I mean, he's the spare. He's an add-on. He's a bit of a handful. William's already done his thing.
Maybe you're right, Ben. That's a good theory. I like it. Now, there's a conspiracy theory I could go with.
But, you know, I think if you're a Thomas Markle or you're a, I don't know what the half-sister's name is, the one.
Samantha.
You have never in your entire life been a news story before. It makes sense that these people now are going to try and get as much.
Sure, they're going to milk it.
They're going to milk it because this will never happen to them ever again.
Talking about milking it, because you know Samantha Markle's Twitter account.
She has a special follower. He asked her and she let him follow her.
Do you know, because she's private, I can't even retweet things. So if I wasn't sharing, you guys would never know.
Okay, go.
This woman is such an attention seeker. Samantha, she says, the bad press over my father doing stage photos is my fault. Of course, now you want to be relevant.
How is it her fault?
She says, the media was unfairly making him look bad, so I suggested he do positive photos for his benefit and the benefit of the royal family.
This is so great.
We had no idea he would be taken advantage of. It was not for money at Kensington Royal.
It wasn't for money after those pictures were sold for like over 100K. It wasn't for money.
It was for money.
Okay, so
he even says it was for money. He just says money wasn't the only motivation.
I now feel better about my own family.
This family couldn't get any worse, could it?
Oh,
I mean, give it time. When is the wedding?
On Saturday.
You see, there's still how many days? Three or four days. Give it time.
And then their whole marriage from there on is going to be besieged by this family every day, every step of the way.
But you know what? I do love the fact, though, that at least up until now, the mother has remained the most civilized one in all of this.
Oh, she must be.
So far, no scandal around her. She's going to have that sit down with Oprah.
Mm. But just imagine how embarrassed she is by the father. Right?
But also, if you throw stuff out before Oprah's interview, Oprah will kick your ass. She will kick your ass.
She's being very strategic.
Yeah. Oprah makes you sign stuff.
Yeah. She will.
You will spill the beans with me, no one else.
Right.
Jeez. Probably locked her in the dungeon with Gail for like 2 weeks.
Did we have to go there?
Is Gail in the dungeon still after all this time?
When last did you see a picture of her?
No, she does her own TV show.
She does?
Yes. Yeah. She's really? On CBS This Morning.
Yeah, Gail's a big deal. She's on TV more than Oprah.
What did you think she was? Just a professional Oprah best
BFF? Yeah, I thought she was in the dungeon.
Oh, well, the Palace have officially confirmed that there is hoo-ha around Meghan's father. They are requesting understanding and respect for Markle's father. This is after there are reports that he would not attend the royal wedding and would not be walking Meghan down the aisle. So in a statement, they commented on this difficult situation. They did not confirm the reports going around that Thomas Markle has decided not to attend the wedding. But nonetheless, they said earlier it would comment on the report at a later stage. They say that this is a deeply personal moment for Miss Markle in the days before her wedding. She and Prince Harry ask again for understanding and respect to be extended to Mr. Markle in this difficult situation. Well,
what do you think?
This is neither here nor there. Why did they even release the statement? Because they aren't saying anything. But, yeah.
What a messy family. Good Lord. This could not get any worse for poor Harry. And Meghan. Poor Meghan. I mean, we think about her. She probably doesn't want anything to do with these people. She's like, I'm in the royal family now. Get away from me.
Mm.
You think about those people who win the lottery, right? And there's always some family member who pitches up out of nowhere.
Mm.
Looks like Dirty D from...
This is when you just have to realize it's not too bad Pudy to tang. Pay people off. Pay Samantha, pay the father, pay the brother off for them to keep quiet for life.
Oh, there's a brother as well.
That's Thomas Markle Jr. And he's the one who wrote the letter to Prince Harry saying, yo, bro, don't marry Meghan. She's crazy.
Wow, guys.
She's not class. Oh, yeah, this is last week. He wrote an open letter to Prince Harry saying, this girl is just not for you. She's not classy enough. She's not worth your time. Don't do it.
No, Meghan should throw the entire dad side of the family away. She should all of them away in a rubbish bin. She must just stick with the mother.
If I were Meghan Markle, says Vin on what's it on Telegram, says I would hire a sniper to kill my whole family. These people are so embarrassing. They're embarrassing her around every corner. Bunch of hillbillies. If I were Meghan Markle, I don't know. You'd have to do something about them. In Mups' stories, Ben, says Michelle. That's where you see his ugly feet.
Okay, fair enough.
Last week's show with Ben and Gord was awesome. The rest of you can go on holiday.
Oh.
Well, that's some good feedback.
Nice.
Early holiday, I'll take it.
People are being thrown away with their feet tied up. As the body rots, the feet come apart, says someone. As people have thought about this.
Gareth, I've got a breaking news story.
Hang on. Guys, I've already been invited to Stephen Hawking's birthday party next month. It was a blast. Raj.
Oh, okay. Good, good, good. Very clever.
Yes, Ben, what's your story?
Gail has gone on Ellen.
Yes.
And spoke about Oprah smoking weed.
No.
I just sent you a clip.
That's unbelievable.
I sent you a clip. If you go to 3 minutes, like 20.
Really, Ben?
She has a tell-all story about marijuana.
Hmm.
This is after she released a massive shirt with Oprah and two dogs on it.
Okay, let's have a look.
Gail's a real deal.
Gail, she's letting the Oprah family secrets out. Because she's pretty much family, right?
I love finding things that I shouldn't be interested in. Gail, this is it. I'm fascinated by Gail.
So where do you want to go, 3 minutes in?
About 3 minutes 20, she talks about.
Right, let's go here. Here it is. Listen to Gail. Here she is talking about Oprah.
So we had a conversation later about marijuana, and I said, I've never smoked a marijuana cigarette. I never have. Maybe that's part of the problem, cigarette. I see you laughing at me. I heard you.
A marijuana cigarette.
Yeah. You, right there, I heard you. Josie said, and Amy goes, well, we have to do something about that. I just never have, Ellen. I'm a big square.
Right.
But listen.
You're willing to try it?
I would try it. I would try with Amy, but I don't intend to do it publicly. I said I would do it with Amy.
It's
Oprah,
legal.
Oprah has also smoked a little marijuana, too. I don't mind saying that.
Yeah.
I'm not telling tales out of school.
Does she like it? Does Oprah like it?
I refuse to answer on the grounds. No. I tend to incriminate her.
No. All right, Trump.
It's not something that happens on Oprah. I'm going to change the subject.
All right.
So how are you?
I'm okay. But you.
That's an admission there about Oprah smoking weed, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Look at that. Now Ben's fascinated. He's going to be watching Gail videos all day. This is what happens, though, in the world of YouTube.
I wish.
Oh, no. It happens. So listen, we had a very controversial issue. And this is quite exciting because Ben was listening with an eagle ear to Lorna Maseko.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Lorna Maseko says... And Ben heard her saying, I love cocaine, during her interview the other day.
Yeah, I thought it was clear as day. She just sort of chilled, having a good time
now,
here.
If she said, I love cocaine, it seemed to have passed me by. But Sia seems to think she said cooking.
Oh.
Which would have made more sense because she does love cooking. She's got that show about cooking and everything else. Maybe that's why I heard cooking. Didn't make much of it. Ben says he's sure he heard cocaine. Listen again. You still loving TV?
Still loving TV, still loving cooking, still loving being me.
Now, is that cooking or cocaine?
It's cooking.
Like, Lorne, I'm sorry, but it sounded a lot like cocaine when I heard it.
Let's listen again. We need our listening detectives to pay attention here. Hey, you still loving TV?
Still loving TV, still loving cooking, still loving being me.
Still loving cocaine, still be loving me, or is it still loving cooking?
It's cooking, just maybe pronounced, you know.
No, the thing is, like, the more you play it, you can hear cooking. It's just that she sort of gets a bit lazy towards in her cooking and goes, cocaine,
cooking. Hey, you still loving TV?
Still loving TV, still loving cooking, still loving being me.
Oh, it could be cocaine. You don't know. That would be a hell of an admission, right?
So well delivered.
Yeah, there's Lorna Maseko. She popped in last Friday, and there we are. She either said cooking or cocaine, depending on what your take on this is. All right, Simon Dingle has written a book, and I'm very excited to talk to him about this because he told me about it 2-3 months ago. And he is currently working on Invest Capital and Phantom Design. He has been a part of the teams that built 22/7, Curve, and Luno, three of the best fintech apps in South Africa. He speaks at a number of events about blockchain, cryptocurrencies, design, business trends, innovation. He's also a broadcaster, writer, and speaker who tries to make complex subjects simple for people like me. So he's been working with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies since 2011, way before it was cool, Mubs, designing products that make it easiest for us to engage with this new world of money. His new book is out. It's called In Math We Trust, and he's on the line. Hey, Simon, how are you?
Hey, Gareth. Good, and you?
Good, man. Well done on the book.
Thank you so much.
I finally got my copy, and I've been breezing through it. It seems to me that you're trying to let even dumb people understand cryptocurrency. Well done. That's very nice of you. Why would you bother?
That's a good question. I don't know why anybody writes a book now that I've experienced it myself. But I was approached by my now publisher, Tracy McDonald, last year, and she suggested that, you know, given all the hype around cryptocurrency and the lack of understanding, perhaps it was time to write a book. And so I did. And as you've suggested, I tried to make it as simple as possible. I think it's a very complicated subject. And everybody's tired of that guy. You know that guy who's at every dinner party and every bri. And all he can talk about is how the world is going to change and Bitcoin. And so as a little bit of
by
an
the way,
antidote
the,
to
the,
all of
the,
that.
Those people were particularly proficient at displaying their cryptocurrency knowledge or lack thereof around December last year. They've gone all quiet. They've gone a bit quiet since then because you got into cryptocurrency so long ago, 2011, that pretty much you're still like 500 or 600% up on anything, even on the worst days. And guys like that who bought in December, they're still struggling to get back up there, and they think it's going to go back up there soon. They're hoping, they're praying, right?
Yeah, well, I happen to agree with them. There's actually a story there because in 2011, when I sort of started getting into it, I was writing a story for FinWeek magazine for the cover about Bitcoin, and it had just hit $1 to a Bitcoin, and it was approaching $9. So, you know, it was steadily ramping up, and everybody told me it was a bubble. And I looked around for South Africans who were involved, and I found this group online that were mining Bitcoin and working with it back in 2011. And I remember having a discussion with one of the guys who was in Pretoria. And I said to him, you know, do you have Bitcoin available? And he said, yeah, I'll sell you. I've got like, you know, 1,000 of them. You can have them for, I don't know, you know, $5 a coin or something. Wow. And I said, no, it's fine. I'll pass it.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if you'd bought 1,000 of those then? What would they be worth now? Have you thought about that?
Well, 1,000 times 8,000 at today's price. So a lot of money, $8 million, I guess.
Jesus. Yeah. And you could have got them for $5 a coin. Oh, man, don't make me sad.
But I did start mining back then and playing around, and I think it was more of a fascination with the technology. You know, back then I wasn't thinking about what it would be worth one day, but rather how cool it was that we had this decentralized currency that threatened potentially the nation state ultimately, but certainly our fiat currencies that we used before, and just offered something better. So it really was just a fascination with the technology. I don't think anybody back in 2011 was expecting to get rich from it.
So how did you get involved in the technology? I mean, how did you develop an interest in this right at the start?
I think it was a natural evolution from my interest in information science. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I was a kid in the 80s in South Africa, and I remember my dad coming home with our first Intel 8086 computer. Yeah. You know, that cost just about as much as our house, and I ripped this thing apart and was just fascinated. And of course, I think gaming is the big gateway drug into computing for most people in our generation.
Absolutely.
But I was just fascinated, especially by what happened when you plug computers into each other and created these information networks. And you know, Bitcoin is just adds to that. It's money for the internet. It gives our information network an economy for the first time, and that in itself is fascinating.
When you started to look into cryptocurrency, you mentioned just a moment ago that for you it indicates that there'll eventually be an end to the nation state, and eventually we'll all just be able to trade freely and fairly with each other without having to have middlemen and banks and everything else. But there must have been some reason that you personally wanted to get involved in it, because from there on it kind of became your career for a while. It became your career to develop apps around this stuff. What was the interest then? Because we all have high and mighty objectives, like, you know, let's disintermediate finance. But that couldn't have been what you were thinking when you started.
No, not at all. And I don't, you know, I don't think that Bitcoin is going to be the end of the nation state. I think we'll still have nation states for a very long time. But I think it threatens some of their power. So that fascinated me. Financial inclusion as a possible outcome here was also something that I found intriguing, you know, especially living in a country in South Africa where, depending who you ask, anything between 5 and 8 million of our citizens can't have bank accounts. Yeah. And I specifically say can't instead of don't, because the banking system doesn't want them. They don't earn enough money. They don't store enough value. And so they're sort of precluded from the digital economy. They can increasingly get online, but they can't do anything online because they can't spend money online, etc. And so Bitcoin, you know, blockchain don't care how much money you've got. It'll let you start a wallet with just a few rand in it. And we can get into, you know, the fees of Bitcoin and how that whole world is changing. But if we sort of look past what's happening today and imagine where it's going over the next 10 or 20 years, financial inclusion, I think, is something exciting. You know, having less power to people who don't deserve it is something that excited me. I've always been, you know, a little bit of a rebel. So yeah. when I see people who I don't think deserve what they have getting punched in the gut, that's mildly satisfying. And so put it all together along with the technology, which in itself is fascinating. And this idea that for the first time you could have things on the internet that were both digital and scarce. That wasn't something that was true until Bitcoin really got underway. You know, if I had a picture of a cat on my computer and I copied it for you, now there were two, and then you could copy it for a friend and now there were three. And so right. We always had this digital abundance from the very beginning. But for the first time we had digital scarcity. I could send you something over the internet and I would no longer have it. Now it's yours,
yeah.
While still being digital, and that in itself is mind-blowing.
That is incredible, and I suppose that's where the major mind-bending principle for many people comes in, because a lot of people are still struggling to get their heads around things like the blockchain and how it works and what its purpose is. But what you've just explained now is that if I copy and paste something 1,000 times on my computer, it's abundant, it's endlessly abundant, infinitely so. But it isn't true for cryptocurrency, and it isn't true for all these tokens. And that's where I think people are starting to understand now, digital scarcity is really what we're after. And you explained that to me about 2.5 years ago. I wish I'd listened more carefully, because I might have been able to start mining or investing in cryptocurrency at a time where really it was cheap as chips. But when you look at the interaction between yourself and maybe let's call it people who are involved in this new technology and the banks, what do you immediately identify as being the differences?
Well, I think for one, we don't need middlemen. We don't need third parties. When Satoshi Nakamoto, who is the inventor of Bitcoin, and nobody knows who he, she, or they were for sure. Mm-hmm. There are many pronouns, but we'll just apply those three. You know, when Satoshi announced it with his white paper, he said that he's been testing a peer-to-peer digital cash that relies on no trusted third party.
Yeah.
And it's that last bit that's really the most important bit, because it means that we can go back to transacting the way we always did before central banks and nation states, etc., which is directly with each other. if I want to buy something from you, Gareth, I can send you some Bitcoin and then you can give me the product and we don't need anybody else involved in the transaction. As opposed to when you go to a coffee shop now, for example, and pay with your credit card, you know, there's a credit card network involved, there's an issuing bank on that card, there's a receiving bank, there's, you know, yeah. The merchant has to have a special kind of bank account, there are fees that flow to all of these parties in between. It's a pretty messy process, even if we have managed to make it quite efficient. And there are a lot of hops involved in that process that just aren't necessary now that we have a technology with Bitcoin where I can pay the coffee shop directly and the transaction is only occurring between me and the coffee shop. And so that really takes us back to the way we used to transact in, you know, our ancient history, in tribal communities. That was how people transacted in ancient Mesopotamia, where they had little clay chip tokens to represent everything from pots of honey to stores of grain and lengths of rope. That's how people were transacting. Now, you know, of course, that didn't scale. So central banks and everything that came with them were handy in the medium term because they gave us a way to scale economies. Mm-hmm. But we now have something that delivers peer-to-peer transactions at scale. And that's incredible. It means that banks get disrupted, but it means that companies like Uber are threatened as well, because yeah. I can have an arrangement directly with the driver now without a middle party like Uber getting any money for providing that service in the middle. So it's the disintermediation of middlemen, which is always the story of innovation. And I suppose that's the most immediate effect of something like Bitcoin becoming very popular.
Well, those are the people who you said earlier you don't think necessarily deserve the money, because they're parasites to the transaction. They're sitting on top of it and not necessarily adding any value, right?
Well, you know, that's perhaps unfair in some cases.
In the past, they certainly added value because they made it possible for us to do these transactions. Now, you've got to question whether or not they're still adding value.
Yeah, and you have to look at, you know, pieces of history like 2009, where our financial systems let us down quite badly. And if you were a taxpayer in America, seeing your hard-earned dollars going to banks to bail them out, mm-hmm. When they had conducted criminal activity and were receiving bonuses as a reward for it.
Yeah.
That suggests that maybe while the system has served us well as a whole, there are these points in history where it failed us quite badly and where actually it exploited, you know, your average person in the street. And so we have something better now. Horses were great, but we've got cars now, so we don't need them anymore. Our system of central banking, yes, it wasn't perfect, but it worked fine. We've got something better now. So, you know, whether it's newspapers that made way for digital media, or whether it's the death of radio and the rise of something like you doing, Gareth, we can't cry for the dinosaurs. And it's not necessary to say that the dinosaurs were cuck either. We just have something better now.
I love this book because you actually tell people how you can you explain to people how you could become your own bank.
Yeah, and that's quite a frightening prospect to most, because when you explore that to its full extent and you talk about how Bitcoin works and how you can store your own keys and be in control of your own financial universe, that's something that's scary. You know, we've all heard these anecdotal stories about the guy who lost his hard drive with all the Bitcoin on it and hired a team to go through a dump to try and find it. That whole idea that I can look after my own value, but if I lose my hard drive or lose my phone or lose this piece of paper, I'm going to lose it all. That's very scary to most people. Until you see the practical implications of what it means to store your own keys and your own value. For example, if you're using a hardware wallet, something like a Trezor or a Ledger device, which are now available in South Africa too, you've got a very secure offline wallet for your digital stores of value. And even if you lose that wallet, you haven't lost your store of value. These wallets require a PIN, and if you put in the PIN three times incorrectly, they wipe themselves out. So if they get stolen or lost, that's not the end of the world, because they have a seed that you can back up on paper in a safe somewhere, for example, or that mm-hmm. you can leave in a safety deposit box that can restore them on any compatible wallet anywhere in the world. You can even remember those seeds. They generally come in the form of 12 or 24 words. And if you can just remember those words, you can restore your Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other wallet that's associated with that seed anywhere in the world, which is also mind-blowing. We call them brain wallets when you just remember a seed and you're essentially storing your wallet in your brain. You can cross a border and be strip searched and nobody can know that you've got potentially billions of dollars stored in your brain, something better than a Swiss bank account. And so when you look at the the practical implications of this. You know, iCloud backups through Apple, which of course are securely encrypted. If I lose my phone, I have a wallet on my phone that can be restored. I can just walk into the nearest Apple store and buy a device. So this idea of being your own bank doesn't need to be a scary one. You know, banks are very handy, for example, when somebody passes away, because you can come with a death certificate and go, I am so-and-so's son and I'd like to access their account, etc. So people worry about that too. But if you just think about it, it's very easy to leave, you know, if you've got 12 words, give 4 of them to 3 different people. And if something happens to you, so long as these 3 people or 4 people can get together, they can restore your wallet. You could leave, you know, seeds with lawyers, etc. So it doesn't matter what way you look at it. This idea of being your own bank works. It can be made pretty safe. And it's something that I would challenge anybody listening to this to at least explore, even if it's just with 10 Rand. Find out what it means to actually look after that value yourself, and not rely on a bank. And I suspect you will catch the virus, as have I.
Do you do any formal banking anymore?
Of course I do. I mean, you can't live in 2018 without a bank account. So yes, I am still very much involved in the traditional banking world, and a lot of the traditional banks are my clients. And I think what inspires me in a lot of cases is that, you know, for the most part, the old world of money isn't looking at Bitcoin necessarily as just a threat and something that'll kill them and trying to combat it. They're actually looking at how they can work with this technology and get involved in the game. And so there are a lot of interesting things coming from that as well.
I love this quote that you put in at the beginning of one of the chapters. I think it's the last chapter in your book, Naval Ravikant, where you said, Bitcoin, or not you, he said, Bitcoin is a tool for freeing humanity from oligarchs and tyrants dressed up as a get-rich-quick scheme. Everybody seems to be very interested in what the value of Bitcoin is now and how you could, you know, take a couple of dollars and turn it into thousands of dollars if you just time it right. But that's not the real value. Blockchain is at the back of all of this. And what the blockchain does is it gives you truth. It gives you an honest and incorruptible technological backbone for us to determine what value really is. And I suppose this is what I'd like you to explain to me and to everybody else. Blockchain technology can be used in so many different places. What is it as a very basic principle, and how do you see it being rolled out to stop tyrants and despots and to help people free themselves?
So blockchain technology is fascinating in and of itself, and essentially it's a way for computers to prove that they've done something. So it sort of evolved from a technology called hashcash that was suggested in the 90s, and was designed to get around the spam problem with email on the internet. So it was a system that essentially came up with digital stamps for email, so computer could prove that it was the computer that sent this email. And also it required computers to do a little bit more work to send an email message than they did in the past, which meant that more resources were required, made it a little bit more expensive, and meant that if you were a spammer trying to send out 1 million messages at the time, your life would become hell because it would just be slow and expensive. And also you'd have to get around the encryption to prove that you were actually the sender of that email. So if you were trying to be somebody else, that would be impossible too. And so we got this idea that computers could stamp things and that they could prove that they had sent it, digital signatures, and they could prove that a computer had done some piece of work. And that's what gave us this idea of digital scarcity. But I do also feel that in this whole discussion of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, a little bit too much attention is given to blockchain technology. Yes, it's an amazing piece of technology and it enables incredible things. There are alternatives to it. Things like hash graphs have been proposed. There's a network called the Tangle that powers a cryptocurrency called IOTA, so there's no blockchain involved in that. But what excites me more about Bitcoin is the story that it presents us with. It really gives us a better story to tell about money. And it's that narrative that I think gives Bitcoin its real power. And so when I say I think Bitcoin is still the most important cryptocurrency and probably will be for years, I think it'll beat out the others, etc., that has nothing to do with technology and very little to do with blockchain. and has more to do with the narrative of Bitcoin, the story of Bitcoin, right, which is always what makes better good technologies win. The classic example that, you know, is touted by futurists every time they talk about it is VHS versus Betamax. And those of us growing up in the 80s and 90s will remember going to a thing called a video store, kids.
Yep.
And we actually used to go and get movies on a piece of magnetic tape that was in a box of plastic, and then we put it into another box of plastic, and it was a mess. But Betamax was one of the options for storing video on tape, and it was better than VHS. But VHS won because it was slightly cheaper. The quality wasn't as good as Betamax, but it was good enough. VHS machines were the first ones to have wireless remotes, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, it told a better story than the other technologies out there.
Right.
So there are myriad cryptocurrencies, and some of them are technologically superior to Bitcoin, or theoretically.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't matter because Bitcoin's got a better story. And that story is one about personal empowerment, about financial inclusion. It's one that doesn't rely on the cult of personality. There's no Steve Jobs in the Bitcoin world because nobody knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is. So, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto is immortal and will never die in a car accident. There was a rumor last year that Vitalik Buterin, who is the founder of the Ethereum cryptocurrency, had died in a car crash and the price plunged overnight. So,
given that
money is a game we play and it's a mythology that we all invest in, Bitcoin offers us the most compelling alternative to that. And it's one in which governments need to try a little bit harder to get tax money from us. They actually need to compel us to pay it because they don't have control over the banking system as they do with central banks, where they have to work a little bit harder and actually show us some value in order to get their tax returns. And where they don't have as much power as they do today because, and this is where we get into the philosophy and the ideology, I think governments have a little bit too much power at the moment. They almost always use it for the wrong reason and very seldom use it for the right reasons. So it's that story, Gareth. It's a better way of being.
I love that. I love your book, In Math We Trust. This is not the kind of book that people need to think hard and long about buying. It's there. It's available. It's not long. You could digest 151 pages very, very quickly, and it's fascinating. Simon, congrats, man. I've obviously known you a long time, and it's really great to see how well you're doing and how much you're making sense of all of this stuff for the rest of us. And I think it's terrific. All these apps you've developed are going to make our lives easier. All these things that you've been involved in and the stories that you tell are the kinds of things that we want to hear. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Gareth. It's always nice chatting to you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we'll also be launching a cryptocurrency, like an idiot's guide to cryptocurrencies and to the whole world of what this digital disruption means. And Simon will be hosting them. They'll come up very, very soon on cliffcentral.com. I'm looking forward to that too.
So am I.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Thank you so much, man.
Cool. Thanks, Gareth. Right. Cheers.
Thanks, Simon. Then get the book. It's called In Math We Trust, The Future of Money.
Yes.
Only people who aren't interested in that are people who say they've got too much money already.
Oh, damn them.
There's only about five of them in the world.
In the world.
Yeah, I mean, who has too much money? Don't be ridiculous. When we come back, we'll do the un-news. We'll wrap it up with a little bit of our own news, and then we'll get to our guest for the morning, who I think you're going to find very interesting. His name is Brett Lads. He's a chef, not just any chef. He's been working for presidents. He's got some stories to tell. Stick around for that. Hey, when is that Deadpool movie here, Ben?
This week.
This week. I'm very excited.
I'm going on Friday.
Yeah. This is David Bowie with Fame. All right, in a moment or two, we'll meet our guest, Brett Lads. He has served as the executive chef of the South African government from 1994 to 2000 under Presidents Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki. During that time, he managed the presidential guest house in Brinterion in Pretoria, cooked daily for the president and his guests, and catered for over 54 state banquets, Mabale.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, a lot of plates.
That's right. We'll find out all about what people ate. Bob Mugabe, the Queen. Who the most fussy guests are. Yeah, some famous people.
Even though we shouldn't judge them based on that.
He was once given a cigar by Fidel Castro. How do you like that?
Sure. Okay, then.
Telling me.
Casual.
So we'll find out all about that with Brett in a moment or two. It is a Tuesday morning on cliffcentral.com. Anything you want to wrap up with here before we get to the unnews?
Well, just one last bit of information. A bit of courtside action again with the former president's legal team expected to make representations to the KZN High Court.
Oh, yeah?
Remember, Sean Abrams was the one that said there's no reason for Jacob Zuma to not stand trial, but his legal team are going in arguing, saying, no, you were wrong. He faces 16 charges relating to the controversial multi-billion rand arms deal. During Zuma's previous appearance, thousands of people gathered to support the infamous former president. There was a National Interfaith Council of South Africa in partnership with the Commission for Religious Affairs. I think there were people from the funeral. There was like some other funeral.
Black First, Land First were there.
Oh, really? Andile supports the president.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, the former president.
Oh, yeah.
Since when?
Oh, no, no. He's been there. He's been there the whole time.
Yeah. Gosh, all right.
Because he's paid for by the Guptas.
Oh, yes, of course. Now, the case...
So it all makes sense.
The case against Zuma has spanned several years.
Oh, yeah.
And you won't believe who was one of the first people to ring the alarm saying that the arms deal was a little bit suspicious.
Patricia de Lille.
It was Patricia de Lille herself.
Poor Patricia.
Back then, a PAC MP, and she told Parliament back in 1999 already that the arms deal could be suspect.
Wow. You see, we should listen to her.
We should listen to her.
Stupid DA. Just get rid of her.
So, yeah.
Those guys wouldn't know a good thing if it jumped out of their Rice Krispies and bit them on their titties.
So, Jay-Z's legal team are going back to court today in KZN, and we anticipate that Zuma supporters will be back out in their numbers again as well. Because, you know, they've got to do what they've got to do.
Can you imagine? Imagine your life is supporting Jacob Zuma. He's not going to support you. I mean, can you imagine him paying out like huge amounts of money to all his supporters? It's never going to happen.
Nope.
So what are they pitching up for?
Just to sing his praises. It's kind of, you know, it's part of the script. It's part of what they expected to do.
Shame.
That's where the difference comes.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, that's all we got time for this morning in the news. But here's the unnews for you, just in case you still need your fill. And when we come back, we will speak to a man who's really seen just about everything there is to see in the incredible world of being South Africa's official government chef, and he looked after the Brinterian guest house in Pretoria. Lots to talk about with him. That's coming up next. First, is Patricia de Lille going to the ANC? The chances are very good. Only speculation at the moment. Rumors are starting to circulate, and it's making Musi Maimane very nervous. So much so, he's wondering if he should join the ANC himself. He's going to spend some time on Twitter this morning and then decide if it would be a popular thing to do. In other news, South Africa's first cryptocurrency ATM is about to open in Johannesburg. There is obviously much excitement around this. People already queuing up at the site. When asked what their first transactions were going to be, they said they don't actually have cryptocurrency. They just want to be the first to be there. Much like the opening of Krispy Kreme, Starbucks, and Burger King, the lit life does not rest. And then finally, SARU have announced that the Currie Cup will be scaled back this year with just one round of fixtures. It will be over before it even starts, something that makes a lot of sense to the powers that be in South African rugby. They're hoping they can actually play the entire tournament as halftime entertainment during a Bok test match. Wouldn't that be great? We shall return with a full show tomorrow, but our guest coming up next is someone you don't want to miss out on, so stick around for that. Cliffcentral.com on a Tuesday morning.
This is CliffCentral.com.